Autumn Shadows in August by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. If you would like to order a PDF download or trade paperback copy, go to www.lulu.com/Robert Norris. Autumn Shadows in August is also available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online bookstores. Chapter 9. We changed trains in Milan. It was muggy, and an overcast sky accented a cheerless atmosphere at the station. I had had a bad feeling about Milan when I spent a night in the station waiting room in 1973 and watched young punks harass old men who wanted only to spend a quiet night out of the rain and cold. I was glad when the train to Florence departed. Two teenage Italian girls sat across from us and watched intently as Coyote flipped through her book about Florence, periodically consulted her electronic dictionary, and jotted down notes in her notebook. The girls got off the train at Lodi and we had the compartment to ourselves. Creedence Clearwater Revival's "Oh Lord, Stuck in Lodi Again" ran through my head. It felt good to take off my shoes, stretch my legs, and elevate my ankles on the opposite seats. I dozed much of the rest of the way. After we arrived at the Florence station, we walked a couple of blocks to our hotel. It took about an hour to unpack and set up the room. Coyote ran a bath. Late in the afternoon, we decided to see the Duomo, which was right around the corner off Via dei Panzani. The street was bustling with tourists. Coyote moved in front of me. We came around the corner, headed up Via dei Serentani, and there it was in front of us, its pink, white, and green marble facade rising up indomitably to the massive orange dome, which seemed to touch the sky. The enormous building dwarfed everything surrounding it. Both of us stopped in our tracks and drew in our breath.
Oh, David, look at it! Oh, David, look at it! It's so big! It's so beautiful! Look how big it is!"
I had never seen such wonder on her face. She staggered slowly toward it, as if in great reverence.
"I've never seen anything like this," she said, and just stared at the imposing Baroque structure for a long time.
Then she reached into her bag and pulled out her camera. We spent the next hour viewing the Duomo from all angles. Coyote took many pictures while emitting exclamations of joy and wonderment. The massive stones, intricate sculptures, and unbelievable scale of it transfixed her. She hardly noticed the hordes of tourists milling around. When her wonder subsided a bit, we strolled along some of the side streets, found an interesting restaurant, went inside, and ordered a dinner of mushroom, tomato, and cheese pizza and beans stewed in a tomato sauce with rosemary.
"Oh, honey-chan," Coyote said between mouthfuls, "this is unbelievable. I just couldn't imagine the first place we see in Florence would affect me like this. I know you told me a lot of things, but I just couldn't imagine it being like this. I mean, Van Gogh gave me the shivers in Amsterdam, but not like this. I saw the Grand Canyon years ago when I was in Arizona teaching, and that made me feel the same way. But that was made by nature. This was made by human beings."
"Do you feel perhaps a bit humbled?"
"More than that. It feels like I've discovered something beyond myself, something far greater than myself. But yet, as a human being, I feel suddenly inspired in some way. Like, at the same time, there's no meaning, and great meaning, to my little life. Now I think I finally understand what you must have felt when you were 22 and in Europe for the first time. This is so wonderful."
Coyote's face beamed as she put a spoonful of beans into her mouth. "I know what you mean. I've been trying for decades to try to find the words that can express what I felt the first time I came to Florence, and I've failed. Words just don't measure up to the depth of personal feeling when you confront a great work of art, especially on the scale of the Duomo. I guess you just have to experience it in the flesh yourself to understand, and there's a lot more to Florence than just the Duomo."
"I think I'm going to love our time here. I'm loving it already, and this Italian food is so delicious. Look at how much I'm able to eat, and my stomach is somehow able to handle it."
Coyote pointed proudly to the empty plate in front of her. "I'm happy that you're happy. Cheers." We raised our glasses and toasted each other. We walked back to the Duomo once more. Cowardy took more pictures while the sun set. The colors reflecting off the stone walls had changed. My ankles were sore, so on the way back to the motel, Cowardy supported my weight as I limped along. The stairs to our third-floor room were difficult to ascend, but I managed with the help of the banister. It was still warm, so we both stripped down to our underwear when we got to our room. I plopped on the bed. Cowardy picked up my left ankle and began rubbing it.
"You know, Honey-chan, I've been thinking a lot about my life since we met Undine."
"Oh, yeah?"
"I don't know what I would do if I lost you."
Cowardy stopped massaging my feet momentarily and gave me a look full of seriousness and passion. "You're very special to me, too."
"We were fated to come together. I really believe that. I think we were both traveling many different paths, and those paths were fated from the beginning to come together. I know I say this all the time, but don't you think so?"
"Yes, it sure seems that way. I believe for a long time that someone or something has been guiding me throughout my life, and it seems that for a long time Thomas was somehow connected to that belief."
Cowardy finished rubbing the left ankle, shifted on the bed, and started on the right ankle. She was quiet for a moment, then said, "I'm glad I got cancer."
"How's that?"
"If I hadn't got cancer when I did, I'd probably be dead now. I believe that. The doctors told me that my cancer was the fast-spreading type, and I know that if I'd gotten that secretarial job for the United Nations Habitat job in Fukuoka, I'd have ignored the pain in my stomach and kept working, and it would have been too late by the time I finally went to a doctor. Do you remember all that?"
"Oh, yes, I remember everything."
"Do you remember what a bitch I was all the time? I really was a bitch when I was interpreting. I hated all those people in the Fukuoka International Interpreting Company. They were always trying to put me down."
A frown marked Cowardy's face. "I remember the pressures you were under all the time, the way your company kept giving you all the most difficult jobs, and the way every job was for a totally unrelated group or company, one week for a Malaysian political group, the next for a California avocado grower, the next a Canadian lumber company, every time something different without enough time to prepare, to learn the new specialized vocabulary.
And I started getting pains in my stomach, and for a while stomach medicine would relieve the pain temporarily, but it got to be too much, and finally I went to the internist. I had to swallow that stomach camera, and they found an ulcer. But just to make sure, he took a biopsy, and a week later the lab report came back with a diagnosis of cancer. The ulcer and the cancer were in the exact same spot. Isn't that amazing?"
Cowardy rubbed her stomach with both hands for a few seconds. "Unusual, to be sure. I guess in that sense we were lucky," I said. "If it hadn't been for the pain of the ulcer, you would have never found the cancer."
Cowardy smiled at me and said, "Honey-chan, you're the only one who understands me."
"I try my best," I smiled back at her.
"Do you understand why I'm glad I got cancer?"
"I think so."
"Cancer gave me a new life. God was telling me to stop my old life. God was telling me that I was killing myself. Cancer is now my great teacher. Just think, if I hadn't got cancer, I wouldn't know about hiking in the mountains. I wouldn't know about taking pictures of nature in the mountains. I wouldn't know the enjoyment of playing the piano and the shamisen. I wouldn't know the joy of teaching English. I wouldn't be learning about Van Gogh and Rembrandt and Michelangelo and the Renaissance. I just feel so alive now."
"Well, you're certainly a lot happier than you were when you were interpreting and working yourself too hard."
"That's exactly the point. I didn't know how to relax, how to enjoy myself. All I knew was work and the frustration of human relations. I felt like I had to fight all the time to protect myself, and I didn't like myself. I think it's a defect in my genes, in my DNA. I was born with the demons of my father and mother, and I created the cancer myself."
Cowardy pointed at herself, then looked down at her scar for a moment.
"That's the thing that makes cancer different from other diseases. It's the one disease that people create for themselves. It comes from inside. Most other diseases come from outside, like viruses. There, that's enough. My hands are tired."
Cowardy put my right foot gently back on the bed, then crawled up to lie beside me. We looked at each other and smiled. I reached over to touch the 6-inch scar that ran in a straight line up from her belly button. I traced the line 2 times up and down, then slowly began rubbing in circles.
"Do you like my scar?" she asked. Oh, yes.
Do I look old to you?
No, I laughed. Not at all. You look great.
I want to be fatter. I'm just so skinny now. I never have gained all my weight back after my operation. It's difficult with only a third of a stomach. I look like a cancer patient, like a skeleton.
Another frown marked Cowardy's face.
No, you don't. You look just fine.
Do you really think so?
Yes, I do. Has your stomach bothered you much with all this different food we've eaten? I asked.
A couple of times I ate too fast and didn't chew enough, and the bile came up again.
Cowardy clenched her teeth in mock pain.
You know how I feel when that happens. It's terrible, but I think I'm doing okay. I just have to be careful to eat slowly. I have a sensitive tongue now. Whenever my stomach has to work too hard, I get a funny taste on my tongue. If I walk around a bit, then I usually feel better. I do love this real Italian food.
Me too.
Are you happy with me?
Cowardy asked suddenly.
Of course I am. We're life partners, you know. I wouldn't change anything we've had together. I think we've had a pretty darn good marriage. We laugh a lot. We like a lot of the same things. We've always talked a lot. We hardly ever fight. How many couples can say that?
I know, but sometimes I wonder if you're really happy with me. I'm not the easiest person in the world to live with.
Cowardy leaned against me. Do you have any regrets about anything?
No, I love you very much, Honey-chan. Maybe you're the only man I could ever have married.
She drew my head to her mouth. We kissed deeply and sensuously. We made love like two self-conscious teenagers. We cuddled afterward, not speaking, breathing lightly, then fell asleep. It was the deepest sleep I had had in a long time. When I woke the next morning, Cowardy was already washing our clothes by hand in the bathroom sink and hanging them in various places in the room. She smiled and said,
"Just like at home, Honey-chan. Did you sleep well?"
"Like a log."
"So, where should we go today?" she asked.
"There's so much to see. Why don't we start with the Uffizi Gallery and take it from there? We have 6 days and there's no rush to see everything at once. Just walking the streets should be fun if my ankles hold up." The next 3 days were grueling tourist days, touring the main sights together, the Uffizi, the Campanile, the Gallery of the Accademia, and Ponte Vecchio. The walking and climbing of many stairs was hard on me, so each day I returned to the hotel early and took a nap while Cowardy continued with her exploring. In the evenings, my ankles revived by a hot bath, we strolled the narrow side streets near our hotel until we found a trattoria that suited our taste and dined on a variety of local dishes. Cowardy was in particularly high spirits, flirting with the waiters and bantering with other tourists. On the fourth day, we went to the Pitti Palace and the Boboli Gardens. We got separated, and I decided to return to the Piazzale Michelangelo to see the spectacular panorama of the city, the sun shimmering on the Arno River below, and the Duomo bulging up from the middle of the city. The sun was hot at midday. The sky was a light blue with thick blue-gray clouds encircling the lower horizon. As I stared in wonder at the feast of colors spread out before me, the profusion of yellow ochres and umbers, burnt siennas and terracottas, and orange roofs and domes, I felt once again, briefly as I remembered the day I'd been here 26 years before, a surge of the power of youth, of possibility, of hope, of a true love for mankind. This feeling swept over me and I was filled with it, and longed for my own youth. I was a little sad Cowardy was not with me now to share the feeling, but I could bring her here later. I descended the hill, walked to a farther bridge, crossed it, and found a shaded park with benches where I could sit and rest my ankles. It felt wonderful to sit down in the shade and watch the world go by. I took a towel out of my bag, wiped the sweat off my brow, then took a long swig off my water bottle. I bent over, took off my shoes and socks, and stretched out on the park bench, my hands folded and supporting the back of my head, and looked up at the tree branches and sky. I thought about how great this trip, our first long trip together since our honeymoon, was turning out and how happy Cowardy seemed. God knew we deserved this break. The last few years had passed quickly with both of us consumed by our workaday lives, and we had not stopped to appreciate what we had. Now each day, each individual moment,
was a precious experience to be savored. I thought back to the beginning of our relationship. There were those roads converging again. I had been in Japan only a few months, working illegally for a conversation school at first, before starting work for an American and his Japanese wife's private school, and managed, through the kindness of others, to find a cheap room and settle in. The visa problem was solved when the school volunteered to be my sponsor for a student visa. After filling out a mountain of paperwork, I applied for permission to work part-time on the student visa. The immigration authorities granted the permission, and I could extend the 6-month visa 3 times before having to apply for a new type of visa or else leave the country. I was in the beginning of that first visa, feeling somewhat secure and gaining confidence in my teaching, when Cowardy joined the school. My initial impression of her was that of a highly motivated student who was spending her own hard-earned money and knew what she wanted. The school was the cheapest and closest one to where she lived, and her main purpose was to improve her speaking and listening skills enough to pass the highest level of the AKEN test, the nationally recognized test of English proficiency. Having that qualification would be a big advantage in realizing her dream of working for a foreign company. Cowardy was placed in the highest level class, which met on Saturdays in the late afternoon. It was a lively class with one middle-aged businessman and 4 women in their 20s. Often, after class, I would go out with the group for drinks, food, and more conversation. At the time, I was entering into a tumultuous relationship with a Japanese woman that would go on for another 2 years, so I had no romantic interests in any of the students. Cowardy, however, stood out to me as an independent woman who knew her own mind. She was fun to be around, intelligent, and interested in many things. We laughed a lot during those classes and the parties afterward. About a year after she entered the school, she passed the AKEN test, soon got a job with a foreign company as a secretary to the president, and quit the school. Her responsibilities included a lot of translation and interpretation work. The company would also pay for her to attend an interpreting school 2 nights a week. At that time, many changes occurred in my life. The relationship with my girlfriend hit a stormy climax and withered. My studies had brought me to the point of understanding just enough Japanese to misread and misinterpret too much. I had reached an age where if I didn't make something of my life soon, there would be no future to think about. I was in my mid-30s, had not sold a single manuscript, had no qualifications, and was caught in the dilemma of whether to return to the States and fulfill the prophecy of the military prison psychiatrists, or commit to the life of an expatriate. If I chose the latter course, I would have to get serious about finding a more stable job than teaching at a conversation school for a mediocre salary. Having a family was something I had avoided, but started to think about for the first time. I was probably more confused than I had been in my 20s, and I was drinking a lot. A short trip back to the States convinced me I was still an outsider there and would never belong. Upon returning to Japan, I set my sights on becoming a university teacher. I found a correspondence course offered at a Tokyo branch of an American university. They offered credits for life experience if one could document it, which I did. Thus started my return to university studies and the long struggle to obtain first a bachelor's degree in English education, then a master's degree. One night, I was out drinking with the businessman who had been in Cowardy's class. We were reminiscing about the members of that class, and he said that he'd kept in touch with Cowardy, who had recently done some translation work for him. He gave me her phone number, and I rang her up a few nights later and asked her out. Everything clicked from that point on as if it had been meant to be. Within a few weeks, we were living together. I quit the previous school after Cowardy helped me find a copywriting job through a job agency that sponsored a work visa and hired me out to large companies. I found another part-time job teaching at a vocational school. I was making a little more money than before, but the important thing was I was making progress on my degree. Cowardy was a huge help in giving me encouragement. The example she set with her own interpretation studies was tremendous. I had never seen anyone study with such dedication.
Every night after work, the two of us would sit opposite each other at the big table in her apartment, surrounded by papers, tapes, textbooks, scattered notes, and dictionaries. I was always the first to call it quits. Things went on this way for a year and a half. Cowardy hinted at our getting married quite often, but I, the confirmed bachelor with itchy feet, wouldn't give in. Cowardy resigned herself to my resistance and started making plans for continuing her own career. There were problems at her company, and the future there didn't look good, so she looked into the possibility of teaching Japanese overseas. A position for teaching 1 year at a university in Arizona came up, and she decided to grab it. I realized I would never find a better life companion and didn't want to lose her, so I popped the question a few months before she was scheduled to start her contract. She accepted, and 2 months later, we were married. I finished my bachelor's degree about the same time. Armed with that precious little piece of paper, I started sending out applications for a full-time teaching position to several vocational schools around the country. An offer came back from one school in Fukuoka that offered a salary that was a lot better than the money I had been making during the previous 4 years. I grabbed it. Within a few months of getting married, Kaori and I took our honeymoon and went our separate ways for a year, she to teach Japanese in the U.S., and I to teach English in another part of Japan. I also had a 3-year marriage visa. The job at the Fukuoka school turned out to be a dead-end street. The owner was a minor league Yakuza type who exploited both students and teachers. I bid my time waiting for a better job opportunity to come and Kaori to return to Japan. A year later, when she did return, I landed part-time teaching jobs at a women's junior college and 2 companies. Kaori found work for a local businessmen's group organizing an international homestay event. We both kept up our studies. I was getting closer to completing my master's degree, and Kaori wanted to pass Japan's highest interpreter's test. We both peaked about the same time. I was 40 when I got the degree and was hired full-time at the junior college. Kaori, then 35, got the second highest ranking interpreter's qualification. We spent the next few years nearly working ourselves to death. Maybe we felt we had to make up for late starts and, as late bloomers, we were obligated to catch up, but both of us eventually produced resumes that put us on a par with almost anyone in our fields. Those were good years for us, but I wondered now about the fixation with which we pursued our goals and dreams. It nearly killed both of us. By the time we'd achieved our dreams, Kaori becoming a simultaneous interpreter for a short while and I a university associate professor, our bodies had broken down under the strain. We had become the very thing I had feared and raged against all those anti-American, idyllic, hippie, dreamland leftist behavior years ago, complacent, middle-class consumers sucked into a rat-race life. I bent down to rub my ankles and wondered if my current chronic pain and illness was worth my achievements on paper. What did it all amount to? In my rush to hack out a comfortable niche in the world of English education in Japan, I had surely sacrificed a good amount of any commitment to a literary life, the one ideal that had kept me going during my 20s, those now distant years of real passion and hope. Here again was another connection with Malcolm Lowry. One of the disadvantages of the expatriate writer's life is that, in living abroad, he no longer has the proper viewpoint or means of existence to use in criticizing the society of his birth and time. At any rate, he is stuck in a time warp as to the type of political criticism he can produce. Isn't the responsibility of any artist worth his weight who seeks to have his work remembered that of providing a critical analysis of the time and country he lives in? In my case, I could write truthfully about the American experience only up to the end of the 1970s. Beyond that, I was limited to exploring just one theme, the struggle of the expatriate to find his niche, to find a place to call home, which, necessarily, eliminates any possibility of a wider political analysis in the structure of whatever body of work he attempts, other than the pseudo-criticism of an outsider viewing the manipulations of a foreign government and society he will never understand simply because he didn't grow up there, didn't absorb the language as a youngster,
didn't suffer the same brainwashing and indignities as the natives, and, again, limits it to an analysis of his own personal struggle. What did any of this matter? I laughed sardonically at the sudden seriousness of my thinking. Fuck it, man, I thought. Go have a beer. I was 49 years old, sick with hepatitis and a rotting liver, had worn out ankles and knees from too many sports injuries, the best years were behind me, and already I was feeling as if all I had left was only memories. Well, I wouldn't allow myself to fall too far into the abyss of fatalism. I could still share some joy and laughter with Cowardy each day. That was enough anymore. There was no need to write the great expatriate American novel, no need to pump out more academic papers aimed at uplifting Japan's outdated and mainly ineffective English education system, no need to point out to the world that politics was a useless medium for real change in the world. There was nothing new to add. There was only one thing to do, accept, and get on with the slow process of dying. I got up, headed back to the hotel, and took a cold shower. Later on, Cowardy and I went out to dinner.
"You look a little less spirited today," Cowardy said after we ordered. "Are you all right? Are you tired?"
"I don't know. A combination of things, really. My hip fatigue has been catching up with me recently. Maybe I'm down a little, too, because of the frustration of not being able to get around like I used to in my 20s. I used to be able to walk and walk and walk, but now I'm like an old cripple hobbling around. And like you've done often on this trip, I've been thinking a bit about my life, kind of questioning the value of what I've done. And these days it seems like a dream, like all the experiences I've had really happened to somebody else."
"I think I understand that."
Cowardy's elbows were on the table, her palms supporting her head as she looked at me. "It just seems that the sum total of everything I've done doesn't really amount to that much." I pushed the food on the plate around with my fork and avoided Cowardy's gaze.
"What are you talking about, Honey-chan? Of course it amounts to something. If nothing else, you've brought great happiness to me. I love you for just you. You don't have to prove anything to me."
"Well, thank you, I know that." I looked up at Cowardy and laid the fork on the plate. But I just wonder sometimes what it was all worth, all the rambling and studying and writing and searching, and now here I am, a middle-aged, broken-down old fart with all the energy and passion I used to have disappearing minute by minute. Cowardy looked at me for a moment, then reached over and held my hand.
"This is unlike you. I don't see you down very often."
"I'm not used to it either," I shrugged. "Maybe it's just a passing phase, but I can't help but see myself differently right now. Maybe as we pass all these old familiar places and sights, I'm a little jealous of my youthful self, and can't help comparing the two me's, actually the many me's," I said, remembering my chess games.
"Well, you might be getting a little older, but you're still the man I've always loved and respected."
Cowardy leaned closer.
"You shouldn't get down on yourself. My God, you've helped a lot of people. Your job is very important. Think about all the students you've taught and who have been affected by your life, your classes, your wisdom, and your humor. You've made a lot of people smile, and your students love you and respect you, too. I know that. You were a great teacher when I first met you, too. Think about the value and importance of standing up to the system when you were a conscientious objector. And what about the mail you've had from other researchers who have read your teaching articles and wanted to cite passages from them? What about the high school kids from England and America who have seen your home page and written you about their research on conscientious objection? I'd say you've helped a lot of people, and your life and work have been very important, especially to me."
Cowardy leaned back in her chair and pointed emphatically to herself. I paused a moment, took a drink of water, and considered her words. "I appreciate your thoughts. I've always tried to help people, and I still take my teaching seriously, too. I think it was good that I came to the education game a little later than most. It took me a little time to find my niche, but I think the experiences I accumulated before becoming a teacher have helped me tremendously. Probably the same goes for you, too." Cowardy thought for a moment, then said,
"Yes, that's true. And being a lifelong student also helps. I haven't had any real formal training to be a teacher, but my experiences as an interpreter and as a language student help me understand my own students' difficulties better. Do you think your master's degree training helped you become a better teacher in the classroom?
Not really. All it did was help me rationalize why what had worked well actually worked well. In the end, I think I learned everything I know about teaching from reading Hesse's The Glass Bead Game.
What do you mean by that? Cowardy asked.
The main character of the story is the most enlightened, revered, intellectual man in an ideal society that strives towards the perfection of the intellect. But at the end of the story, he faces the biggest challenge of his life. He finds himself in a situation where he must teach a colleague's rebellious teenage son, to whom the master's intelligence and intellectualism mean nothing. The boy challenges the master to a swimming race in an icy lake in the mountains. The master accepts the challenge, but in so doing drowns and teaches the boy the greatest lesson the boy will ever receive.
Cowardy raised her eyes and said, "Which is?"
"Well, different readers will probably have different interpretations, but mine is that humility and effort are utmost if one is to make something of one's life. The master was humble enough to accept the boy's challenge to a physical competition, knowing he would lose. The master chose to communicate on the boy's level of understanding rather than insisting the boy rise to his, which he knew the boy, in his arrogant and youthful pride, would not."
Cowardy frowned. "But that was foolish of the master. His humility caused his death. That seems a bit stupid to me."
"I think you have to think about the symbolism. The master was sick and dying anyway. He couldn't teach the boy anything from a purely intellectual point of view. Only by sacrificing himself could he communicate anything of worth to the boy. The boy's guilt would consume him, change him, and make him go on to do better things than he thought himself capable of. At least that's how I see it."
Cowardy thought for a second, then asked, "What does that have to do with what you've learned about teaching?"
"Just that the teacher has to communicate on the student's level if he wants to inspire them. Each new student is entirely different from the rest and requires a completely new effort from the teacher. It's not how much you know or how great your academic record is. That may be important in terms of how your colleagues view you, but the students could care less. It's the sincerity and genuine interest that you have in them as individuals that serves to stimulate them, to guide them towards self-discovery."
"I knew you would cheer up if I got you thinking about teaching," Cowardy said and reached across the table to give me a playful nudge.
I laughed and we clinked our glasses in a toast. The next day, Cowardy accompanied me to the Piazza Michelangelo. My ankles were functioning pretty well and I set a fast pace as we walked along the road running parallel to the Arno River. I was hell-bent on making it to the summit and sharing with Cowardy the great view of all of Florence. My strides were long, and I wanted to cover as much distance as possible before the effect of the aspirin wore off. I stopped for a moment and looked back to see Cowardy was perhaps 20 meters behind me. There was a bench shaded by 2 trees up the street a short way. I walked up to it and sat down to wait for Cowardy to catch up. I took off my shoes and socks and stretched out my legs. When she caught up, she sat down on the bench and looked at me with an intense eye.
"I know you're challenging yourself," she said. "You're pushing yourself. Walking so many kilometers and climbing high places, I can see that. I can't believe your ankles aren't swollen more. You're like those monks who do Sennichi Kugyo."
"What's that?"
"I'm not sure what you say in English. Sennichi Kugyo translates into something like 1,000 days of doing strenuous exercises, or 1,000 days of punishing the body, something like that."
"What kind of body punishment do you mean? What monks do that?"
"The monks who do that are members of Mikyo, which is a strange kind of Buddhist cult. The monks in Mikyo really have to do ijimeru to their bodies, punish their bodies. It's really a kind of interesting group."
"So how do you know about these monks?"
"Shiba Ryotaro wrote about them in one of his books. You remember who Shiba is, don't you?"
"Yeah, the guy who wrote historical novels and also wrote the book on the history of Japanese-Dutch relations that you brought with you." I leaned over and started putting my socks and shoes back on.
"That's right. Anyway, he wrote a story about these 2 famous monks who lived over 1,000 years ago. One was called Kukai, and one was called Saicho. Kukai was born in Shikoku, and he had this vision of the world. He was entirely different from other Japanese at the time, and he went to China to study Buddhism and learn the Chinese language, which he supposedly mastered in a very short time. When he came back to Japan, he opened his own temple. Shiba's story was about his adventures and discoveries. I really don't know that much about Saicho.
Kaori thought for a moment, then continued.
If my memory is correct, about 3 or 4 years ago, this monk from Saicho's temple finished his 1,000 days of punishment, and his picture was in the paper. He looked really thin, and he had a pretty long beard.
Maybe that punishment is some kind of penance, I said.
Yes, Hani-chan, penance is the word I was looking for.
Yeah, I laughed. It's not exactly the type of word you use in everyday conversation. So, what kind of penance do these guys have to do?
They have to fast and walk for maybe a week at a time without sleeping. Probably just from doing that they see a kind of hell. They have to walk over mountains and through valleys, and their walking speed is incredibly fast. There are still monks like that one a few years ago who do that in Japan.
And you think I'm like those crazy monks?
Yeah, the way you insist on pushing yourself.
Kaori gave me a sudden serious look.
I know it's painful for you to walk. I was watching you from behind, and I suddenly thought of Saicho and Kukai. Kukai's temple is in my home prefecture. I've seen it a couple of times myself.
Well, I suppose you're right about me pushing myself. I appreciate your concern, but I don't think I'm going to the extreme those monks do. I know when I've reached my limit, and I try to rest my legs as much as possible. It's just we have so little time, and I do want to see as much as possible. We may never have another chance to do this again. Besides, I think you'll see how worthwhile the walk and climb to the top where we can see all of Florence is once we get there. It's a kind of heaven that makes my little hell of pain seem small in comparison. You'll see.
Okay, Hani-chan, but just try not to overdo it,
Kaori said, and gave me a light punch to the arm. We proceeded to the Piazzale Michelangelo. It was a clear day with a light breeze, and the view was even better than the day before. Kaori was speechless as she looked out upon the stretch and sweep of the city below, and the velvet hills in the distance rising gently to meet the pure turquoise sky. We continued up the hill to the church of San Miniato al Monte and its huge cemetery. As we entered the church grounds, there was a sign that read, "You are in a church. You are not allowed to behave indecently." It stunned me with its inference of an omnipotent presence judging our every action, invading our every thought, much in the same way Lowry was haunted by the sign he had seen in a small Oaxacan garden. Le gusta este jardin, que es suyo, evite que sus hijos lo destruyan, which he mistakenly interpreted as, "You like this garden? Why is it yours? We evict those who destroy." We spent nearly an hour looking at the frescoes, paintings, and mosaics, then rested on the steps above the cemetery.
"We're making more good memories, aren't we?" Kaori said.
"Yeah, this place is every bit as beautiful as it was in 1973.
"You know, I think I've seen more paintings since we came to Europe than I have in my entire life. It's given me a new perspective. Do you remember when I translated that article you wrote about Lillian Hellman's story, Julia, and you told me about the title of her book, Pentimento?"
"Yeah, I remember." I picked up a pebble and tossed it in the distance.
"Well, after studying so many paintings and all these museums and churches, I think I finally understand the connection Hellman made with how a painting changes by the layers of paint applied to older layers of paint, and how a person's memory of the past changes what that person's view of reality is as time goes by. Do you understand what I mean?"
"I think so," I said. "I'm certainly seeing my past differently these days."
"Maybe it was like that for Undine. I mean, your visiting her was like a fresh covering of paint and helped her look through the surface of recent years and see the reality of her life with Thomas when their business was prosperous and he was in his good time. I said this before, but I think your coming helped her, and she needed to talk with someone who remembered about those times. You helped her see the painting of her life through fresh eyes."
I looked at Kaori and laughed. "You're becoming quite the philosopher.
I guess Florence has a tendency to do that to people.
And you know what else I've noticed here?
No, but I have a feeling you're going to tell me.
They don't have street musicians in Florence like they do in other European cities. They have painters. Have you noticed that?
Not really, but I guess you're right now that I think of it.
We smiled at each other. I was happy that Cardi was fascinated by everything she was experiencing on this trip. Each of us, in a separate way, was exploring themes of color and form and thoughts of life and death. Cardi in her discoveries of art and art history, I in my reborn psychedelic musings.